Dr. Chuck Morse. Welcome to the program. WMFO 91.5 AM, Tufts University, Medford, Somerville, Boston. The number here is 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. I apologize that my voice is a little bit tired today. I do have a cold. I've been a little bit out of the loop for the past couple of days, which means I missed the whole imbroglio around the Charlottesville horror and the attempt to basically shift the tables and blame President Trump for this. Why was President Trump to blame for this? Well, he didn't say he was, he didn't recognize, you know, the white supremacists soon enough. He waited this many hours before he did it. He didn't recognize the Nazis. Yeah, I think that we want to have our leaders exactly identify the nature of what's going on. That's a very important aspect of leadership. A criticism that was often lodged against President Barack Obama, for example, was that he never really identified the nature of radical Islamic terrorism when that's what was going on in situations under his watch, when people were beheaded or when there was shootings at, for example, in San Bernardino or at a gay club in Orlando, Florida, and many, many other cases. He would never bring himself to identify what this was and what was going on. So Trump has fallen into that same bad habit that leaders often do, and it's really a reticence that is really not great leadership at all. You know, we want to have our leaders identify exactly what the nature of the enemy is. Ronald Reagan did it when he identified the evil empire, Soviet Union. He contrasted that evil empire with our superior way of life. And this began the ball rolling very quickly toward the disintegration of that evil empire. Franklin Roosevelt did it during World War II when he called for the unconditional surrender of the Nazis. And he identified the evil nature of Nazism and contrasted it with our superior set of values. We could go back to the Civil War. I mean, Ulysses Grant did it when he said that he would accept nothing but complete, unconditional surrender of the Southern Rebellion. George W. Bush, to a certain extent, did it after 9/11. So we need our president to do that. I think that a lot of the reasons why he didn't do it is because of his unique, I would say, and sometimes convoluted speaking style. He often does not speak directly on an issue. He tends to extemporize. It can be very aggravating to people like myself, who is a big supporter of President Trump. But I think once you get used to that speaking style, you can understand that he means well and that his heart's in the right place. And that his enemies are going to parse his words and try to enforce their old and corrupt political correctness on him. So far, that hasn't worked. Maybe it might work now. I don't know. They really think they got a hot one. God willing, it doesn't. But nevertheless, we should address the actual issue at hand. President Trump said that there was blame on all sides in that conflict over there in Charlottesville. And I think that in an investigation by the Attorney General Jeff Sessions and FBI Director Christopher Wray will hopefully tell us what went on there. Regardless of whether there was, I would strongly suggest that the Nazis and the white supremacists were the worst of the two. I mean, there's no question about that. And we're going to talk a little bit about who they were and what's going on with that. But before I go there, let me just, again, get into this business of the many sides of that conflict. The fact is that the other side, the so-called Antifa, those people came into Carlottesville much more violently. The people, the you know, Unite the Right, so-called, they had a permit to rally at the statue of Robert E. Lee, and they were there legally and they were there peacefully. It's not that they weren't expecting possible trouble, but you know, from what I could tell, and again, this is, we'll have to wait until ultimately the investigation is completed. They were there for a peaceful demonstration against the tearing down of the Robert E. Lee statue. Now, included in their numbers were Nazis and white supremacists who are not there for good reasons. Those people are despicable and loathsome. But most of the people there were actually just simply there to show support for the statue. And I don't think that that's... I personally don't have any place for statues of Confederate generals. I'm a Northerner, right? I'm a Union guy. But I don't think that it's necessarily true that those images are evil or that they're racist. I do think that using the Confederate flag is racist. It represents secession from the Union. It represents slavery. It represents a cause that was one of the worst, probably the worst, certainly the worst, in American history. And so I do not think that having Confederate flags on official government properties or Confederate flag images as part of a state or city or in official capacity is right. I think that's wrong. I think that should be stopped. But I think that to tear down all of the statues, that's a bridge too far. I don't think that that runs against, historically, what I would call the spirit of Appomattox, which was that at the end of the war, when Robert E. Lee sat down with General Ulysses Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, they signed papers and they exchanged memos that ended the insurrection and did so in a spirit of reconciliation, of even friendship, and of a return to, you know, righting the ship. There was an understanding that slavery was evil. There was an understanding that the South had been defeated. There would be no more secession from the Union ever again. And that there was an understanding that African Americans would receive some kind of a recompense, which they never really did because Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. But nevertheless, the spirit there was one of reconciliation. The South loved Lincoln, actually, at the end of the war because they knew that Lincoln was not going to be a vindictive, radical Republican who would go in with the army and completely crush the South, which was the, in a sense, how things were done up until that point in war. And certainly if you look at the history of the world, if you look at going back to the Roman times, going back to Europe, the victor would completely plunder the defeated party and would take over and enslave everyone. I mean, slavery was over, but nevertheless, the South expected a strong and vindictive vengeance against them. And in fact, they'd already seen some of that with General William Sherman's march to the sea in Atlanta. And the understanding was that that would not happen, didn't happen. The Southern soldiers were allowed to return home with their arms, by the way, with their weapons, and that they would be loyal to the Union again. They would be go back to their states and rebuild their lives. And so for that reason, and for the spirit of Appomattox, I actually believe as a Northerner that we ought to preserve those monuments and we ought to understand them in their context. I mean, Robert E. Lee went on freeing his slaves and rebuilding his home state of Virginia, which is what he did for the rest of his life. I don't know how long he lived, but that was the case with all of these people, with one or two exceptions, one of them being, of course, the very evil General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who went on to form the Ku Klux Klan. Now, that's true also, of course. But there are radicals on all sides here. And the Ku Klux Klan was crushed in the 1870s by President Grant, who, when he was told about it by Frederick Douglass, who was his guest at the White House, he became so concerned that he sent General Sheridan down south to find them and crush them, and Sheridan did just that. So the Klan was destroyed and really didn't come back until the 1900s under the racist presidency of Woodrow Wilson, and the movie Birth of a Nation made it trendy again, which is interesting. But the idea of rallying to preserve this monument, I think, was appropriate. I do not think it's appropriate to destroy these monuments. I could get why maybe Baltimore wanted to take theirs down, because Baltimore, after all, is in a state that did not secede from the Union. I don't know what the heck they were having Confederate monuments for. So that's fine. But, you know, I guess the question is, how far do you go? There's already talk about dynamiting Stone Mountain in Georgia, which has, Confederate images. President Trump is right when he points out that there are people who want to tear down the Jefferson Memorial because Thomas Jefferson had slaves. Why not tear down the Washington Monument because George Washington had slaves? In fact, there's renamed Jackson, Mississippi, because Andrew Jackson had slaves. You know, it's kind of like, it gets to a bigger agenda here, which is a leftist agenda to essentially erase, and this is the nose under the camel's nose under the tent as a means of erasing all of American history. You know, Karl Marx talked in the Communist Manifesto and in other works and pamphlets about the importance of erasing or changing the history of a nation so the people don't remember who they are, then they're more susceptible to collectivist approaches. So I think that there's a bigger agenda here. And in fact, there was a tweet that was uncovered by multi-billionaire currency grifter and convicted felon George Soros, who finances a lot of these things, and who said, we'll go after the Confederate monuments first as a way of completely changing the American system of racism. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, I mean, I think that it's safe to say that George Soros is a communist, and his idea of changing the system of, quote, racism is his desire to move toward communism. So, I think that that's where I stand with this. I think that, yes, remove the Confederate flags from official edifices, but leave the monuments in place and think of them in the context of the spirit of Appomattox, where over 500,000 Americans on both North and South lost their lives and were killed or were forever maimed in fighting that stupid war. But the war that, but yet the war that did end slavery, thank God, and it was a terrible price to pay. So, you know, let's. Anyway, so that's my position on it. But President Trump, of course, has gotten into trouble because he didn't come out fast enough identifying the racists and the anti-Semites. So now somehow he's to blame for this. And the left is holding this up as proof that he, not only he is an anti-Semite and a racist, but as are his supporters. And that's a lie. One that should be challenged vigorously. And by the way, it's now come out that one of the main operators in this this sort of Unite the Right movement is a guy named Jason Kessler. And Jason Kessler was formerly affiliated with the Occupy Wall Street movement. He was a big Barack Obama supporter, major liberal who now all of a sudden has had a change of heart and has gone to the right. Now, really, how likely is that? I think that this raises, I mean, this is an obvious case, in my opinion, and certainly more research needs to be done. But it's an obvious case of a setup. He is an agent provocateur, or a provocative agent, to use the anglicized version of the term. Which is to say that the left, and this is classic leftism that goes back in history. I mean, this is nothing new. That in order to create a dialectic, they will either set up a phony front group with their own people in charge posing as the opposition, or they will infiltrate and subvert existing groups with their people posing. And then once they're involved and once they're ingrained and once they've co-opted the system, they continue to go on with the charade while engaging in activities that are beneficial to the left. And in this case, that would be, you know, controlling the so-called racists, you know, the white supremacists, and making them look evil, and you know, they are evil, but making it into like a major thing so that there can be this dialectical conflict, all to undermine and distract the genuinely progressive agenda of President Donald J. Trump, in my opinion. So, anyway, as you can tell, my voice is a little heavy today, so I sure wouldn't mind getting a call if you're out there. Chuck Morse every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m. You're welcome to join me, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. So, let's see. Let me go to my article, my latest article on Newsmax.com, which actually deals with this subject. And let's see. It's called, it's out there today if you want to read it. White Supremacists and Antifa, Both Anathema to American Values. I had somebody email me about this saying, how do I define American values? Maybe we'll get into that in a minute. President Trump responded to the hate and violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, by noting that many sides are to blame. There were, in fact, two sides that instigated the violence, both radical, both socialist, both anti-American. The racist and anti-Semitic neo-Nazis and white supremacists on one side, and the radical communist so-called Antifa on the other, or the anti-fascists on the other. Each side represents a philosophy that is anathema to America. In the tradition of terrorism, both sides benefit from the provocation and the attention that it draws. Trump's reaction is like that of conservatives in past decades who condemned both Soviet communism and Nazism and who accurately blamed both sides for causing World War II. Like today, with lines drawn between white supremacists and Antifa, both sides back then, the Nazis and the communists, were radical socialist and anti-American. Back then, except for the period during the 1939-1941 Hitler-Stalin alliance, the American left criticized only one side, the Nazis, while giving a pass, if not openly praising, the other side, the communists. Now the left is seizing upon the opportunity that the violence presents to side with one side, Antifa, by claiming that President Trump's condemnation of both sides means he is siding with one side, the side that hates black people. In this regard, they engage in classic left-wing projection. They think that Trump and conservatives view the world as they do, which is unnuanced. Either that, or they engage in classic leftist propaganda with full and conscious knowledge that they are lying. They go one step further in their attack against Trump by condemning, by proxy, his, quote, base, those of us who support him, by claiming that we also support one side, the racist side. This is an opportunity for Democrats and liberal Republicans to come out and pound their chests with righteous indignation as they advance a false dialectic. They have no problem fanning the flames of racism and anti-Semitism that one side represents for their own political capital, while they tacitly side with the other side, the violent Antifa. Shame on them. The Trump haters, those who are willing to tear apart the fabric of American society to feed their seemingly unquenchable hatred for Trump, ought to look in the mirror before charging others with racism and anti-Semitism. These are the same people who support the Jew-hating movement to boycott Israel while ignoring Israel's genocidal enemies, who they tacitly excuse. These are the same people who have supported perhaps well-meaning but racist liberal policies that have hurt the African-American family, faith, entrepreneurialism, and safety over the past half century. Like the Nazis and the communists of the past, the white supremacists and the Antifa embrace an atheistic collectivist view that is anathema to American conceptions of private ownership, limited government, and rights emanating from the individual under God and not from the state. The white supremacists and the Antifa are both obsessed with race and race identity and the destructive politics that emanates from this belief. They both reject the position that Donald Trump and the majority of Americans support, which is the principle of putting the interests of all Americans first. And that means just that. All Americans. So, there you have it. That is my column this week on Newsmax.com. You're welcome to check it out. White supremacists and Antifa, both anathema to American values. What is the cause of this rise in the Ku Klux Klan which has not just been happening this year. It's been happening over the past maybe 4 or 5 years. And white supremacists, putting aside the question of whether or not they are controlled by agents provocateurs, which I think is an interesting question. On the surface, and why do they support Trump? Well, I mean, I think that Jeff Kooner from WRKO made a very interesting comment about that. They support Trump because they constantly hear, day in and day out, the fake news media saying that President Trump is a Nazi, he's like Hitler. You got people like, Robert B. Reich writing columns about how Trump is a fascist. And so they look at that column and they say, great, he's one of us. We better support him. We like him. And also, it should be noted that President Trump, by putting America first, he wants to crack down on illegal immigration. And that does mean non-white immigration. And that, yeah, there might be some racial sensitivity around that. Some people are uncomfortable with having massive numbers of non-white people coming into this country. I think that that should be admitted. I'm not a supporter of that. And I don't think it's racist, per se. But it should be acknowledged that the idea of massive numbers of non-white people coming into this country from other cultures makes some people uncomfortable. I think that the real locus of that is not necessarily their race. I think it has more to do with their culture and whether or not that culture is compatible with American notions of culture. There are some serious questions with regard to whether or not, for example, frankly, peoples from various parts of Asia and Africa and South America embrace the same principles that we embrace. Not that they can't, they certainly can. But there's a concern that if you let in massive numbers of people who don't, or who don't at varying levels, then that could in some way downgrade all that we've achieved in terms of many centuries of individual freedoms and individual rights. A basic understanding that rights do not come from the state. There are a lot of things that make us who we are. Those are universal principles that can be embraced by any nation or group or individual, but for various reasons has not been embraced in various parts of the world. And there is concern that this lack of understanding of democracy and of American principles, limited government and the rest, the Constitution, may not be consonant with their views. And if they come here in masses, then we may have to conform to their views. That's a concern that has always been there in the United States every time we've had waves of immigrants. And it's a very important question. Every nation has a right to determine its immigration policy and whether or not it's in the nation's best interest, and more than just economically, but also culturally and socially and all the rest. And I think it's safe to say that in past centuries, like in the 19th century, when there was concern over Irish immigration, Jewish immigration, Italian immigration, Polish immigration, right, French immigration from Canada, that those concerns proved to be unfounded, that the new immigrants were eager to embrace American ideals of culture and American ideals of limited government and democracy. And I would say more recently, immigration from China, from Vietnam, from the Philippines, from Korea, has been one that's been very, very successful, because you have people who want to come here because they want to assimilate into the American way of life. They want to, you know, embrace the American system. And so concerns around them have also proven to be unfounded. There's nothing wrong with the concern. But fortunately, in those cases, those immigrant groups did embrace American values, and thus they enriched this country immensely. I think that the same could be said, frankly, for Latin America. They absolutely embrace American values. The question with Latin America is illegal aliens, not immigration. I would hope that a means could be discovered by which Latin American immigrants could find a pathway to citizenship. If they can prove to be able-bodied and able to work and pay their taxes and be self-sufficient and self-supporting, and then we ought to find a way to help them immigrate here. This is an important way to empower our nation. The problem is we have to find a way to do it legally. It's not a matter of being anti-immigration from Mexico or from any other Latin American country. I think that there's a concern on the part of Americans that criminals are sneaking into the mix. If we have a system in place where people can be properly vetted, then we can weed those people out and welcome in people who are willing to come here and work and support themselves and not be a burden on the system. To me, that's appropriate. That's what my great-grandparents did. Of course, they didn't have welfare back then, but I don't think they would have taken welfare. They wanted to work. So immigration has to be done in a way that benefits the country. It's that simple. That's what putting America first means. If it benefits us economically, if it benefits us socially, if it benefits us culturally, then we ought to have immigration. If not, then we should not. That's what sovereign nations do, all sovereign nations, or any sovereign nation that deserves to be called a sovereign nation. That's why we have sovereignty. It's just like the same way you decide who goes into your own private home. We decide as a nation, through our elected representative government, operating on our behalf, who enters into the national home. And so you have sensitivities around that that are leading to perhaps an increase in the supremacist movement. But I think that there are two factors that need to be addressed that are more fundamental to this. One of which was brought up to me recently by a college-age friend of mine, a relative actually of mine, who pointed out to me that the reason why you have the rise of neo-Nazism and white supremacy, and she points out to me that most of these people are men and white men, young white men, between, you know, the teenage years, early 20s. And by the way, they're the same type of young men who are predominantly recruited by groups like ISIS or the Communist Party or previously the Nazi Party back in Germany. You have young, disaffected, impressionable men who feel alienated from society and who are told, in the case of the United States, by this tyranny, this oppressive tyranny of political correctness, something that President Trump rejects, and I think does so for all of us, that they ought to shut up and not be heard, that they are privileged because they're white. And most of these people are not privileged, by the way. I get the concept of white privilege. I know historically the United States has given white dominance, you know, power to white people. That's a fact. There's no getting around that. But in the case of the white supremacists, these people are not privileged. They're mostly poor, or they're uneducated, or they're backward, or they're failed in for various reasons. They have not had many of the privileges that others of us have had. You know, they come from broken families, if you look at it, where we've had a stable family. We've had loving parents. We had parents who had the financial means to give us a relatively good life. So we are privileged. And by the way, that includes people of all races. But these are white kids who are told that they're privileged when they're not. They are told that if they say anything that's not politically correct, they're racists. If you disagree with affirmative action, you're racist. If you disagree with welfare, you're racist. If you say certain words, you're racist. If you talk about crime in Chicago, for example, which is predominantly black-on-black crime, you're racist. Never mind the fact that ignoring that is racist, in my opinion. But the point is that whatever you say in the public square, you're going to be shut down as racist. You're going to be silenced in the political correct arena. And thus you have the building of resentment and anger, which can turn into rage and alienation. The second factor that I think is fueling this rise of white supremacy and Nazism is this obsession on the part of the left on race. And we could take a look at the way this is manifested on college campuses, probably including our own campus right here at Tufts University, where you have people who are obsessed with the idea that you are different because of your race. If you're white, if you're black, if you're Hispanic, if you're Asian, whatever it is, that this comes to define you as if it means something, as if it has some kind of an external meaning. Now, someone's race and someone's ethnicity has meaning to them as individuals, or maybe it doesn't. It's kind of a personal matter, and it really, frankly, is no one else's business. You know, I mean, it's personal. I mean, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be demonstrated publicly and be proud. I do. I happen to be Jewish. I don't have any problem associating myself publicly as a Jew and getting involved in Jewish affairs, getting involved in Israel affairs. I'm very much involved in that by choice. But I don't want to be defined by someone else as a Jew. I mean, I don't want to be told because you're a Jew, you have these certain attributes. In fact, I view that, frankly, as anti-Semitic, or at least tending to be. I don't want to go that far. But that's what's going on campuses. That's what the left is doing. They are defining people based upon their race, their ethnicity, their sex, whether you're male or female, their sexuality, whether you're gay or straight, or whether you're transgender or whatever, you know, you're transforming. This becomes the defining factor of who you are. And you begin to think of yourself in those terms. I think that's detrimental. I think that that is leading to white consciousness in the same way that you have black national consciousness. You know, it started in the 1960s with the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X. Now you have Black Lives Matter, which I think is, frankly, a black nationalist group. And a violent group on top of it, I'd add, responsible for the deaths of many policemen. And you've got, you know, Hispanic groups like what is it called? Centra or something, you know, Aztlan, I believe it's called, where they're calling for a separation of the southwestern part of the United States into a new nation or emerge with Mexico, right? I think it's called Hecha, actually. And you got other radical groups like that. You've got most of them financed by left-wing white people, ironically, in these big foundations, like the Ford Foundation, which have been completely co-opted by the left. And you have this hyper-awareness of one's identity. You know, it becomes a part of your identity to the degree that you actually come to believe that you are different. So if you're black or you're white or you're Hispanic or you're Asian, you come to believe in this paradigm that you actually are different than someone else and that you are alike other people of your racial background. That's wrong. That runs against the American creed. You know, whatever happened to the late, great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said very eloquently that his dream is that someday his children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their characters. That's the American creed. We're a nation of entrepreneurs. We're a nation of thinkers and creators and imaginers. Now, I'm not suggesting that racism isn't out there. I personally don't really know racists. I mean, I honestly think that this country has made major strides in that area. And I think that while, since I can pass as white, I don't know exactly what it is like to be a black man and to have people aware of my race because I look different. I get that. You know, that's an issue. But I think that it's something that we ought to look at as a glass half full, if not more than half full, in that we've overcome. That today a black man can walk down a street in South Boston at night with headphones on. I saw this the other day. And not be concerned. I'm not suggesting that there aren't racial instances. I'm sure that black people have had them happen more than enough in their life. I get that. I've had anti-Semitic instances happen to me. I don't want to get into it, but it's happened. I've had people attack me for being a conservative in really ugly ways, hateful ways. You know, we all have those crosses to bear. But I would suggest that racism as an institution has largely gone by the wayside and that we really have made strides. And left-wingers who are engaging in this hyper-racist or racialized consciousness are doing a great disservice. I think that this has a lot to do with the increase in white supremacy to the degree that it has increased. And I'm even not sure about that. I wonder if this whole thing isn't just, you know, an attempt to create, you know, take people on the far fringes of society who would otherwise be ignored and promote them. I'm going to just do a brief comment here about that also because people who listen to this program know that I'm working on a book. And I'm hoping to have it finished by Labor Day. I don't know if I'll quite make it, but I'm really close to finishing it. It's fascinating. It's a book about the history of American assassination plots. People who were either assassinated or there was some kind of a plot, some kind of a conspiracy to assassinate them. And I've dug into conspiracies going from back to Alexander Hamilton right up till today. I've already covered the Kennedy assassination and what I call the Kennedy body count, which is people who died under mysterious circumstances who had some kind of connection to the Kennedys, including Marilyn Monroe, by the way. And now I'm up to George Lincoln Rockwell. George Lincoln Rockwell started the American Nazi Party in 1960, and he was shot dead in 1967, I think it is, or 68, coming out of the Nazi headquarters, which was his house in Arlington, Virginia, and going to a laundromat. And the more I look into the background of George Lincoln Rockwell, it seems very improbable to me that an American would set up a Nazi party in the United States in 1960. There had been none. There never was, I mean, going except maybe before World War II. And that he was a phony. I mean, you can see that he was a showman. He was very good looking and he was charismatic. And he would pull off these ridiculous stunts, really loathsome and awful stunts, where he would have like hate rallies and he would call them hate nannies as opposed to hoot nannies, which was what folk concerts are called. First of all, the idea that anybody would openly call themselves haters is suspicious to me anyways. He started a record label, you know, called Hate Nanny Records. He ran an ad agency. He was a huckster. He was a promoter. He's a publicity man. And he would pull off these obnoxious, ridiculous stunts, like riding a hate bus through the South to follow the Freedom Riders. He also, by the way, was friendly with Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad because they shared at least a stated ideology of separatism and racism. But the more I dig into his background, the more I am concluding that he was an agent provocateur. You can see it from his own writings, that he had meetings with the Communist Party, that he was financed. He was very slick. How did he get the money to have these rallies with these fancy, you know, stages that would pull up with, you know, with slickly pressed Nazi uniforms and people goose-stepping around? Somebody had to pay for that. It was a show. And he just was, he loved the limelight. The publicity was something that he craved. So he was swept up in it. Not that it matters, but it should also be noted that there were always rumors about his party members being gay, and there's a possibility that he might have been murdered in the course of a gay falling out or something. That's possible. Who knows? Who cares? The point is that the media, the liberals in the establishment, would run him up the flagpole and big pictures and articles and say, you see, this is conservatives. This is the right. This is, you know, people that are trying, you know, like William F. Buckley Jr. or Barry Goldwater at the time, right? This is what they're doing to Donald Trump now. Look at this, you know, this is, what they really are. This is who they really are. And then you'd have all these smart alecks from, you know, universities come down and intersect and dissect every little nuance and talk about the milieu that they're creating and the what they're doing in their brains and their cerebellums. And, you know, you'd have all this kind of analysis and psychoanalysis, and this is really the face of conservatism. And, of course, you have this nincompoop, George Lincoln Rockwell, just soaking it all up and playing along, whether he was winning or not. He probably wasn't. And he was, you know, he just was on for the ride. It was created, in other words. And I think that it's safe to say that this isn't something that's unusual for the Communist Party. And even to a certain mild extent to liberals, even though they may not be conscious of it. You know, like, for example, how is it they like, last, not this year, but in years past, they held up this crazy church. I forget what they called it, the 7th Street Baptists or something. Because they were, like, protesting at gay funerals. Oh, my God, they got on national television, and they'd have cameras and interviews. And I remember some of my left-wing co-hosts, my left-wing radio colleagues, you know, we're having this person on, you know, from this church, because they were being held up as the straw man for what conservatism is. I think that I bring this up because I think that that's what might be going on here today. You know, the left is giving up. They're not concerned about the violence because they've given a pass to the so-called Antifa, which are about as fascist as any group I've seen. And, you know, previously to Black Lives Matter and Occupy Wall Street, you know, these were violent leftist organizations that promulgated violence and lawlessness. So it's not the violence that bothers them. In fact, they thrill over the violence. They've never had anything. They've never been. I haven't seen people this excited in years. It's the fact that both sides are essentially controlled ultimately by the same people. And, you know, they play off of each other. In my article, I compared it to the Nazis and the communists in the pre-World War II period. They were both socialists. They were both anti-American. They were both leftists, frankly. And yet they were fighting each other in the streets in Weimar Germany. And they were both benefiting from that fighting. They both were enhancing their recruitment. They were enhancing their visibility. They were enhancing their marketing. They were enhancing their appeal. Until eventually one side won, and that was the Nazis, in the case of Russia. In the case of, I mean, Germany. Now, I'm not suggesting that the same could be said exactly here, but it does make me wonder what might be behind this, because, you know, we ought to be thanking God that we have Donald Trump in the White House and that we're healing racially over these past decades, frankly, and that Barack Obama didn't do a damn thing for black people, frankly, with due respect, while Trump actually wants to go in and deal with some of the horrors that the left has brought on that community. In spite of the left, the black community has largely integrated. They're in the middle class, they're in the upper middle class, they're in the wealthy class. They're into business, they're into all the things, all the blessings that America has to offer, in spite of the left, which has tried to marginalize and isolate them with welfare, with destroying the black church, being liberal on criminals so they can roam the streets of black neighborhoods and terrorize 98% of people who are black who are trying to get on with their lives. We should be glad and grateful that President Trump is sticking a pin in that he wants to do something different. He wants to put America first. And when he says that, he means all Americans. all Americans. So you might want to think about that the next time you hear some twerp talk about, well, he didn't say condemn the racist this day, but he didn't do it that day. It's a bunch of crap. Don't pay any attention to that. He's doing us a good deed for all of us by pushing that away and by saying, no, we're not going to be run by these leftists who are going to put us under a microscope and focus on destroying mountains and statues rather than dealing with actual policies that could improve our lives. Let's have some policies like entrepreneurialism, lowering taxes so we can have capital to invest in business and get started in business. Control over immigration so that we can increase the value of American labor. Whatever happened to that? You know, American labor has been working for 100 years to reach the level it's at. You know, labor is a commodity. I'm not saying people are a commodity, but labor is a commodity. And just like any other commodity, it needs some protection from supply and demand. So if you let in cheap labor, the demand for these advances goes down. What about protecting that? What about protecting American workers? What about protecting American trade in a way that benefits us? American economic policies that benefit us all around the world and domestically. That's what Donald Trump is trying to do. So the next time you get wrapped up in some of these hate campaigns, think about that. Think for yourself. Stand up and say, you know, I don't think I'm gonna wake up. I'm not going to go along with this. We have an opportunity here in this country right now. It's one that comes along once every 100 years. It may be our last opportunity. Let's embrace it. Let's cherish it. Let's not fritter it away. Let's understand it in its proper context so that we can, as citizens, become as sovereign and as free and as prosperous as our government wants to make our nation. Anyway, I'm reaching toward the end of the program. I want to thank you for bearing with me. I know that my voice is very tired today. I'm hoping I'm better next week when I come back. Check out my column, which of course is available at newsmax.com. I don't get paid for this, so I can mention it. Just go to newsmax.com and go to the opinion page, and you'll see my columns. My column this week, again, is called White Supremacists and Antifa, Both Anathema to American Values. And, of course, this show is podcasted at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, a lot of places. Anyways, you can check it out by just putting Chuck Moore Speaks into your server, and up it will come. So I'm looking forward to the return of the students in a couple of weeks. I am expecting to have Milo Yiannopoulos on the show probably sometime in September or October. I'll wait to confirm that. He's very controversial, very interesting. He has a lot of very interesting things to say. Very interesting guy. And onward and upward, you know, it's a great privilege to be back in the air and to hopefully lend some thought in my own humble way to the firmament of our higher education system and of one of America's most preeminent and beloved college campuses. So I think on that note, I shall say have a good day, everybody. When we got there, she hit me with the news right between the eyes. Yeah, she said she couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. She said she couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. She couldn't. No, she
cha-cha. Ooh, my baby couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. I told her not to worry, they'd play some other dance.